disappear. I've seen that road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to your door. The wild and windy night that the rain washed away. Has left a pool of tears crying for.
Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and joining me in the studio today, as is her sometimes wont, Kathy Smith Bowers. Hello, Kathy. How are you?
Hello, Jefferson. I'm just fine and delighted to be here.
Yeah. What you got in store today? I hear your guest got the flu.
One of my guests got the flu. I was really excited tonight that we were going to have in the studio poet Ione O'Hara and her son, poet Bill Van Every. Poor Bill has come down with the flu, and
bummer,
Bill.
And Bill, if you're out there listening, hope you get well soon.
Yeah, get well soon. Take care of yourself. We will definitely find another Sunday evening when you two can join us for the Laureate's Hour, and when you're feeling all better.
Right. You know, it's very spring-like outside today, so I'm thinking we may be nearing the end of flu season. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's like in the 60s. It's great.
It's great. It's wonderful out there.
Flu season can't end soon enough. There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, so what
are we going to do today?
What we're going to do, Jefferson, is, as you already know,
you did confirm.
we decided to use this time to read, in honor of Valentine's Day, which is tomorrow. We're going to read poems that the poets that first made us fall in love with poetry.
Gads.
And so it's always a delight for me to go back to the poems that that really made me think, I want to do this stuff.
I want
to do this stuff.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah. And so what we'll do, Jefferson, if it sounds good to you, is we'll take turns.
All right.
Does that sound good?
Sure. Yeah, you go first.
I'll go first.
All right. Okay.
And so we'll... You know, we led you in with with one of my favorite Beatles songs, "The Long and Winding Road," and I thought that would be appropriate because when I first came to know contemporary poetry, I was in college. It was probably the year 1970, and I was taking a contemporary American poetry class. And before that, I had a British literature class. And so it was during the year probably of around 1970 that I really knew that I already knew that I loved poetry and the power of language, but I knew this is what I wanted to do. So,
all right,
I'll read a poem first, Jefferson.
All right, yeah. Who were you reading in 1970?
Well, yeah, 1970. But the poet that in my memory mm-hmm. is the one that made me totally fall in love with language mm-hmm. and what language could do was the British poet Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Oh yeah. Right. I believe the title of your most recent book is actually derived from Hopkins poem.
It is. The title of that selected and previously uncollected is Like Shining from Shook Foil.
Indeed. Sock it to us.
Okay, so I couldn't decide. There are just so many that of Hopkins poems that I remember totally falling in love with, and I fell in love with simply the language of the poems. And I read them over and over and over until I could recite them, and I recited them over and over and over until I began wondering if they actually meant anything. You know, I knew that the sounds were just, you know, who cared about meaning.
Right.
But
it's so gorgeous. Could it also mean something?
It is so gorgeous. Yeah. Could it also mean something? And, of course, I started looking up words and indeed.
Mm-hmm. Hopkins kind of requires us to go to the dictionary.
The good thing is
which is a good thing.
Yeah. Before even going to the dictionary, though, that it's just such a pleasure to read the poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins.
He gets you with the music.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read The Wendover.
Okay. Great.
And this has the dedication to Christ our Lord. Interesting thing is I was big-time atheist when I fell in love with Gerard Manley Hopkins. I thought I was. So, right. The Wendover to Christ our Lord. I caught this morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dawphin, dappled on drawn falcon in his riding of the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy, then off forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, O air, pride, plume, here buckle. And the fire that breaks from thee then, a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. No wonder of it. Sheer plod makes plow down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion.
Lovely, yeah. A little lesson in rhythm there as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sprung rhythm.
Sprung rhythm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just wonderful to feel those words sort of roiling around in your mouth, and it's very sensuous and mm-hmm. sensual, and it's just a gorgeous poem.
Yeah, it is.
Just a gorgeous poem.
I'll
The window.
Definitely concede that.
Right.
Yeah, one of my favorites. Of course, if you like Hopkins at all, you got to like The Wendover, because that's mm-hmm. one of the pinnacles, as it were, of his art, I think.
And if those of you who are listening, if this is the first time you heard that poem and you didn't get it, you're okay.
That's all right. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Read it again. Yeah.
Well,
and you know, he's the man whose work was almost lost. I mean,
It
was only through the intervention of Robert Bridges that he actually came into print. And Robert Bridges is a poet no one reads anymore, though he's kind of interesting in his own way. But he was the poet laureate, I believe, of England, and he befriended Hopkins and actually they had a correspondence, and he became Hopkins' editor after Hopkins died at an untimely age. I mean, Hopkins was, what, 50 at that? 40
maybe. Yeah, I think maybe 40s.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, though.
But, right.
I tell you, his poetry certainly has made an impact on many, many, many poets.
Oh, yeah, and, countless.
And, you know, what really, the my evolution as a poet myself, again, it started with just simply a love for the sound of words and rhythm. And I fell in love with it. Yeah. I fell in love with it.
Yeah.
So, well, Jefferson, what about you?
Well, of course, I, started reading Frost, I guess, and a bunch of other folks in high school. I grew up in Charlotte, you know, not too far from Lancaster, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we read all the standard guys, but I don't think I actually got, you know, myself into it until later. I think actually it was my high school English class with Miss Bawley that actually led me into reading real poets like Pound and Eliot and all these guys. But they weren't really the first people I really, really got. Actually got Eliot and Pound later. I came back, circled around, got them back again through the Black Mountain poets like Olson and Greeley. But the guy who first got me as a poet, you know, aside from Chaucer, Van der Apio bitter shore, sota the drought of March hath pierced to the rota, and bothered every vein, and switch liqueur, of which vertu and gindered is the fleur.
I wish you would stop cussing.
I know. It's, fortunately, I can do it in my English. Was Randall Jarrell. And I my whole reason for going into the program in Greensboro was the fact that Randall Jarrell was there, and of course he died shortly after I'd applied, so I never got to actually meet him, but I loved his work, and
me too.
Some powerful stuff. I mean, in terms of that strain of American poetry, he's like really good. And of course, if you know Randall Jarrell's work, you probably know this one. It's The Death of the Ball-Turret Gunner, which is just an incredible little poem. The Death of the Ball-Turret Gunner. And this is, like, of course, coming out of Jarrell's experience in World War II. He was actually never a pilot. He washed out after about 6 weeks or something like that.
Washed out?
Well, he failed as a pilot. They washed him out, which is what you did. You know? And he became a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
And never went overseas, but he would nevertheless, you know, learned a lot about war, about the army. I mean, you know, the whole country was going through this terrible paroxysm, the whole world, and it was literally a world war. So being a poet, of course, he could ken these things without actually having to be a ball-turret gunner.
Mm-hmm.
So, from my mother's sleep, I fell into the state, and I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from earth, loosed from its dream of life, I woke to black flak and the nightmare fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose.
They law.
But I guess Jarrell was probably best known for his later work. And, you know, this is The Death of the Ball-Turret Gunner is a persona poem, as we would say these days. And he was probably best known for his persona poems, where his voice took on, you know, inhabited, as it were, another body.
Mm-hmm.
And he was especially good at female personas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's curious. It's a curious thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. But, you know, Jefferson, I want to comment on that little poem. Last line, too, is one of the best things I've ever heard. And I don't know who I heard this from, but I think it's something good to remember when you're writing, especially about subjects that almost beg for sentimentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you really want to move your reader, be cold. Mm-hmm. And man, that last line, when I died, they washed me out of the turret yeah. with a hose.
Yeah, there's not a tear there.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think some of his later work does get a little, I love The Lost World. You know The Lost World? It's mm-hmm. all, on one level, it's an incredibly, it's just an amazing technical achievement because it's all written in terza rima, you know, which you don't even notice until you know, somebody mm-hmm. says, hey, you know, what's that? Yeah. What's that pattern about? So he was, in his own lifetime, considered sometimes to be sentimental and maudlin and mm-hmm. blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in his best work, I mean, all that gets, you know. And let me run this one by you.
I'd love for you to run it by me.
This is The Woman at the Washington Zoo. The saris go by me from the embassies, cloth from the moon, cloth from another planet. They look back at the leopard like the leopard. And I, this print of mine that has kept its color alive through so many cleanings, this dull, null navy I wear to work and wear from work, and so to my bed, so to my grave, with no complaints, no comment, neither from my chief, the deputy assistant chief, nor his chief. Only I complain, this serviceable body that no sunlight dyes, no hands suffuses, but dome-shadowed, withering among columns, wavy beneath fountains, small, far off, shining in the eyes of animals. These beings trapped as I am trapped, but not themselves the trap, aging, but without knowledge of their age, kept safe here, knowing not of death, for death, oh, bars of my own body, open, open. The world goes by my cage and never sees me, and there come not to me as come to these, the wild beast, sparrows pecking the llama's grain, pigeons settling on the bear's bread, buzzards tearing the meat the flies have clouded. Vulture, when you come for the white rat that the foxes left, take off the red helmet of your head, the black wings that have shadowed me, and step to me as man, the wild brother at whose feet the white wolves fawn, to whose hand of power the great lioness stalks purring. You know what I was, you see what I am. Change me, change me.
Whoa.
Yeah, he was pretty good.
Pretty good. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was okay. Yeah.
And oh, you know, wow. and a North Carolina poet, which was
yay.
I mean, he lived here, taught at Greensboro for 20 mm-hmm. years. So
yeah.
Wow. From 1947, I believe, right mm-hmm. after the war.
Mm-hmm.
Left New York. Had been poetry editor of The Nation, blah, 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 written mm-hmm. books of criticism and so on, and mm-hmm. and settled in Greensboro, North Carolina, of all mm-hmm. places. Mm-hmm. So there you go. Yeah.
Two wonderful poems, the two of Randall Jarrell's.
Yeah.
It was lovely to hear those again. I haven't read either one of those in a few years, but powerful stuff.
Yeah. It was good to dig those out again. And, you know, any honest account of my adventures as a poet starts there, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it does.
That's a good start.
Yeah.
Because he certainly was one of my, you know, in my contemporary American poetry book, he was one of the ones in there. And I remember those two poems and Nestus Gurley and...
Right. Oh, yeah. Next Day. Remember The Next Day?
Well, there's also one about the snowman, the boy and the snowman. And
oh, right.
There's one that that almost or sort of pushes across that boundary and mm-hmm. from sentiment into sentimentality. But you know what? It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, he's earned it. He earns it in other places in the poem, I think.
So. Yeah, and we all have our stronger and weaker work, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, he does. And he was also a translator of Rilke. I mean, that was probably the first place I encountered Rilke's work was in reading Jarrell.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
yeah, right.
Somebody told me he had a sort of a lisp and called himself Wendell Jarrell. Or was that just a joke?
I think that was probably a joke.
That was maybe a joke. Yeah. Somebody pulling my leg.
I did.
My poetic leg.
Your poetic leg. I did get, there's an audiobook that was published probably a decade and a half ago now by Random House of Randall Jarrell. I think it's In His Own Voice. That was this, The Poet in His Own Voice or something like that, some series of that order, which also has some other fascinating recordings by H.D. and Gertrude Stein and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I was listening to that the other day, and I was struck by his voice, which is a very, has a different pitch and mm-hmm. so on. We'll come in, we'll play that sometime.
Okay.
We'll play that.
So they get to actually hear Randall Jarrell.
They can actually hear Randall Jarrell.
Instead of us, even though that was quite a lovely reading.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a little musical break.
All right.
And be right back. Coltrane. I used to actually whistle my favorite things on the way in to campus from the dorm every day.
You did?
I did. It's very strange. Yes, right.
I just walked around reciting Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, so after Hopkins, what where'd your imagination go?
Oh, Lord. Well, you know, as I mentioned, I took a contemporary American poetry class at my alma mater at Winthrop College in Rock Hill. It was 1970, and I was just blown away. And I was blown away by many, many, many poets for many reasons. But one of the poets, we've had two guys. We've had Gerard Manley Hopkins and Randall Jarrell. And so I think we need a woman now. And so I'm going to, one of the poets that, she's really a poet who has set a standard for almost everybody who, you know, has come after her, is Elizabeth Bishop. And what I learned from, you know, whereas it was the just the power of language and sound and word choice with Hopkins, what I learned from Elizabeth Bishop was the power of, or the realization of what can happen inside on not only an emotional level, but an intellectual, an attitudinal, is that a word? Level?
Sure.
Is that a word?
Yeah, yeah.
It is now?
Uh-huh. Right.
When you look closely at things, look closely at things. And Elizabeth Bishop had a way of looking at things, the most mundane things even, as if she were looking at it under a microscope.
Yeah, and then it would effloresce into some other...
It would. And then also, as the speaker of the poem is looking and really paying attention to the thing, the person's attitude changes. Something happens simply by looking closely at something.
Yeah, by being drawn into...
Yes, right. And paying attention to it. So this poem is one of her most famous poems, and it's called The Fish. I caught a tremendous fish and held him beside the boat half out of water, with my hook fast in a corner of his mouth. He didn't fight. He hadn't fought at all. He hung a grunting weight, battered and venerable and homely. Here and there, his brown skin hung in strips like ancient wallpaper, and its pattern of darker brown was like wallpaper, shapes like full-blown roses stained and lost through age. He was speckled and barnacled, fine rosettes of lime, and infested with tiny white sea lice, and underneath two or three rags of green weed hung down. While his gills were breathing in the terrible oxygen, the frightening gills, fresh and crisp with blood that can cut so badly, I thought of the coarse white flesh packed in like feathers, the big bones and the little bones, the dramatic reds and blacks of his shiny entrails, and the pink swim bladder like a big peony. I looked into his eyes, which were far larger than mine, but shallower, and yellowed, the irises backed and packed with tarnished tinfoil, seen through the lenses of old scratched isinglass. They shifted a little, but not to return my stare. It was more like the tipping of an object toward the light. I admired his sullen face, the mechanism of his jaw, and then I saw that from his lower lip, if you could call it a lip, grim, wet, and weapon-like, hung five old pieces of fish line, or four, and a wire leader with the swivel still attached, with all their five big hooks grown firmly in his mouth. A green line frayed at the end where he broke it, two heavier lines, and a fine black thread still crimped from the strain and snap when it broke and he got away. Like metals with their ribbons frayed and wavering, a five-haired beard of wisdom trailing from his aching jaw, I stared and stared, and victory filled up the little rented boat from the pool of bilge where oil had spread and a rainbow around the rusted engine to the baler rusted orange, the sun-cracked thwarts, the oarlocks on their strings, the gunnels, until everything was rainbow, 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 and I let the fish go.
Nice, some good Elizabeth Bishop there. Yeah, she was like, you know, hung out with Robert Lowell and not Jarrell as much. I mean, but they were all associated within a quote-unquote school of poetry, as it were.
Yes, yes. She and Robert Lowell were good friends for many, many years.
Corresponded for, yeah, decades.
And there's a book now, a wonderful book of their letters, the letters between Bishop and Lowell.
Yeah, yeah.
And they dedicated poems to each other.
Right,
and,
right. Yeah. I probably should have brought some Robert Lowell, except that I... You know, because he was.
I know.
One of those
I wanted to bring Skunk Hour, but
yeah,
you know what?
Yeah.
We have 1 hour, so I couldn't read Skunk Hour.
Right.
Well, Jefferson, what do you have for us?
Well, after a while, I was still, I guess, in Chapel Hill when I discovered. Of course, you know, like most young poets, I was in writing groups, I was taking courses, I was doing tutorials in poetry, whatever, any way I could get, you know. And I had friends, fortunately, from all over the place. Not like all over the place is now. Like I didn't have friends
like
from China.
All over the place.
Yeah, yeah. But I had friends from all over the place. In the sense that I had friends from New York and Connecticut. You know. And... one of them introduced me to the work of Robert Creeley, and I've got to say that took the top of my head off, and probably, you know, just. And so let me share a Creeley poem. This is when Creeley, you know, here I was in Chapel Hill, which is in North Carolina, and the State University of North Carolina, right? I'd never heard of Black Mountain College, which was also in North Carolina, closed in 1956-57.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the idea that a lot of this stuff, you know, happened in the same state. It was, like, kind of mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
But no one in the academy knew him at that point. I mean, here I was hearing about him from a fellow student who just happened to dig his work, you know, mm-hmm. and heard him read in New York at a bar, you know, and dug his work. So, and so this is, let me read you a couple of Creeley poems.
I would love
these are the ones that
Creeley
I really
poem.
Liked. This is one, Creeley left this one out of his own, of his selected works. And so it wasn't until Ben Friedlander did a selected poems after Creeley sadly passed on back in 2005 that this one returned to print. The Business. To be in love is like going outside to see what kind of day it is. Do not mistake me, if you love her, how prove she loves also, except that it occurs a remote chance on which you stake yourself. But barter for the Indian was a means of sustenance. There are records.
Whoa! He had a way.
He did have a way.
He did have a way, didn't he? Wow.
And the one that took my socks off, as it were, was The Ballad of the Despairing Husband.
Okay.
And he did so many. This mm-hmm. early work is, you know, rightly praised mm-hmm. and kind of become a permanent part of the language. And here, Creeley had been living in Majorca. He'd been studying the traditions coming out of Provence, you know, the ancient Arnaud Daniel, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is... his version, maybe, of a Provençal poem. Ballad of the Despairing Husband. My wife and I lived all alone. Contention was our only bone. I fought with her, she fought with me, and things went on right merrily. But now I live here by myself, with hardly a damn thing on the shelf, and pass my days with little cheer, since I have parted from my dear. Oh, come home soon, I write to her. Go fuck yourself, is her answer. Now what is that for a Christian word? I hope she feeds on dried goose turd. But still I love her. Yes, I do. I love her and the children, too. I only think it fit that she should quickly come right back to me. I know, she says, and she is tough and smacks me down with her rebuff. I know, she says, I will not come after the bloody things you've done. Oh, wife, I tell you true, I never loved no one but you. I never will. It cannot be another woman is for me. That may be right, she will say then, but as for me, there's other men. And I will tell you, I propose to catch them firmly by the nose. And I will wear what dresses I choose, and I will dance. And what's to lose? I'm free of you, you little prick. And I'm the one can make it stick. Was this the darling I did love? Was this that mercy from above did open violets in the spring and made my own worn self to sing? She was, I know, and she is still. And if I love her, then so I will. And I will tell her and tell her right, O lovely lady, morning or evening or afternoon, O lovely lady, eating with or without a spoon, O most lovely lady, whether dressed or undressed or partly, O most lovely lady, getting up or going to bed or sitting only, O loveliest of ladies, than whom none is more fair, more gracious, more beautiful, O loveliest of ladies, whether you are just or unjust, merciful, indifferent, or cruel, O most loveliest of ladies, doing whatever, seeing whatever, being whatever, O most loveliest of ladies, in rain, in shine, in any weather, O lady, grant me time, please, to finish my rhyme.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That kind of poem, because I remember Robert Creeley being in my contemporary American poetry class, in the book, not in the class, in my book, and loving his poems, and a poem like that, you mean, wow, you can actually have kind of fun in a poem, and...
Right.
Be sarcastic and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's got all kinds of tonal things happening there. Yeah.
You can do other things besides I wandered lonely as a cloud.
Right.
But, of course, he later wandered lonely as a cloud.
He later wrote a poem that began with that as well and took off.
Really?
Yeah, right, right.
Well, I must have been picking up some vibes there.
you must have been.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. So that's a little Robert Creeley.
So,
let me actually, I'm going to share one more of Creeley's work. And this is a later poem. This is not something I ran into as a mere, youth. But this is a late poem. This one came out in his last book, actually. The Way. Somewhere in all the time that's passed was a thing in mind became the evidence, the pleasure, even, in fact, of being lost. So quickly, simply that what it was could never last. Only knowing was measure of what one could make hold together for that moment's recognition, or else the world washed over like a flood of meager, useless truths, of hostile incoherence. Too late to know that knowing was its own reward, and that wisdom had at best a transient credit. Whatever one did or didn't do was what one could. Better at last believe than think to question. There wasn't choice if one had seen the light, not of belief, but of that soft blue glowing fusion seemed to appear or disappear with thought. A minute magnesium flash of fireflies illusion. Best wonder at mind, and let that flickering ambience of wondering be the determining way you follow, which leads itself from day to day into tomorrow, finds all it ever finds is there by chance. A little late Robert Creeley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's listen to another tune.
Okay.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her. Then she gets you on her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. To travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Now Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. And she shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning, they are leaning for love, and they will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
He must have been a favorite songwriter of yours.
Oh, still is.
Yeah.
Still going hot and heavy.
He's still traveling and still on tour.
Yeah. Because he hit the scene in the 60s, early 60s, right?
I knew his work in the late 60s, but that's me. I don't know when when he got underway. But about 68, 69, 70, somewhere in there.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was in Buffalo by the time I heard Leonard. But
Well, thinking back to the poets that I really was drawn to.
You have to include Sylvia Plath.
You have to include Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
And the thing I think that I learned from Sylvia Plath is she just had this determination to say things in such unexpected and fresh ways. And sometimes, you know, most of us, you know, who are writers, our strength is also our weakness. You know, so her strength was that she could find the freshest way of expressing something, especially metaphors.
Right. So how did that become a weakness?
Well, because sometimes she went too far,
and
you totally went,
exploded the poem. Or,
do what? But I really learned a lesson, you know, push the language, you know, don't settle for cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned that from her.
Yeah.
And so here's a little poem that is often anthologized that in which she not only tries to come up with a fresh metaphor, a fresh way of looking at something, but she actually does a catalog of metaphors. And so I'm going to read this poem twice.
All right.
The first time I'm going to read it, and then the second time I'm going to make sure that everybody knows what she's talking about, and then I'm going to read it again.
Okay. All right.
So the poem is called Metaphors. See if you can tell what this poem is really about. The tenor of a metaphor is the actual subject of concern. So, and she has a catalog of vehicles. So she doesn't reveal in the title the actual subject of concern. So this poem is called Metaphors. I'm a riddle in nine syllables, an elephant, a ponderous house, a melon strolling on two tendrils. Oh, red fruit, ivory, fine timbers. This loaf's big with its yeasty rising. Money's new minted in this fat purse. I'm a means, a stage, a cow in calf. I've eaten a bag of green apples. Boarded the train. There's no getting off. So she does some really wonderful things with this little poem. So what's her tenor, Jefferson? What's her subject of actual concern?
Read it again, Kathy. Let me hear it again, because that's a good question.
All right. Okay, let me give you a little hint.
Yeah.
Well, the first line, of course, is I'm a riddle in nine syllables.
Yeah.
There are nine lines to the poem, and every line has only nine syllables in it. And even the word metaphors has nine letters. So, in other words, think of the significance of the number nine, okay?
Right.
So here we go again.
All right.
Metaphors. I'm a riddle in nine syllables, an elephant, a ponderous house, a melon strolling on two tendrils. Oh, red fruit, ivory, fine timbers. This loaf's big with its yeasty rising. Money's new minted in this fat purse. I'm a means, a stage, a cow in calf. I've eaten a bag of green apples, boarded the train. There's no getting off.
I don't have a clue. Enlighten me.
It's about being pregnant.
Oh.
I'm a riddle in nine syllables, an elephant, a ponderous house, a melon strolling on two tendrils. This loaf's big with its yeasty rising.
Right.
Money's new minted in this fat purse.
Money's new minted.
In this fat purse. That's my favorite.
Okay.
I've eaten a bag of green apples.
Yeah,
boarded the train. Right. There's no getting off.
That's true. No getting off. Okay. All right. Yeah.
And, you know,
that's one of hers I don't know, actually.
It's just a lovely, a fun little example of her desire to look at a single thing in as fresh a way as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, she does
it.
Or in eight or nine. And, you know, it turns, there are lines that are delightful, funny, and yet that last line turns to a rather stark feel there, boarded the train.
Does this come out in the Ariel poems? Do you know?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I'm not sure though.
Yeah, I can't say that. Yeah.
But of course, boarded the train. There's no getting off. It's chilling, actually, considering what happened to her. You know, she had these two babies, and when they were still babies, stuck her head in a gas oven, and so I guess she did feel that she
and
had
got off,
had boarded the train.
Yeah.
There's no getting off, and she found a way of getting off.
Getting off at least
well, that train.
The only way of getting off that train.
Except, of course, we know there were many trains that Sylvia Plath was trying to get off or thought she needed to get off. But she certainly has been, for me, I continue to go back to Sylvia Plath. And she continues to have things to teach me.
Yeah. Well, the thing I like about Sylvia, as opposed to the other, like, other confessional poets who have their virtues, of course, including, like, for instance, Anne Sexton and so on, is that Sylvia had a real love of language. I mean, that carried her. She was a student, I mean, of poetry. I mean, she was, she knew poetry at a depth that lots of her contemporaries did not, I think.
So, I agree. And, and you know, at the time that I was falling in love with Sylvia Plath, I was also falling in love with Anne Sexton, who taught me other things. But now when I go back and read Anne Sexton, her poems don't resonate the way that Sylvia Plath's poems still resonate. Because so I think you're right. I think with Sylvia, it was the craft. It was the language. And I think with Anne Sexton, it was, I shouldn't even say that because, I, you know, from what I know about Anne Sexton, she worked like a demon on the craft of her poem.
Yeah.
So,
but she had a very different approach. I mean, you know, it was more about
The emotional
unveiling or whatever the poem,
So, all right, Jefferson, it's your time.
Well, gee. I guess I'd have to go to Gary Snyder. I've got, you know, there were a lot of people who, a lot of poets whose work came into my life at about the same time, from 65 to 68, say. But Gary Snyder was certainly one of those. And so I'll leave Robert Bly and James Wright and Wendell Berry and all these guys for a different time. Because I have to talk about Gary Snyder. Besides, the moon's in Taurus, I believe, today. So,
gosh. You know what we need to do? We need to do this and do a marathon.
Yeah. A couple hours or something like that. Yeah.
Maybe we can do it and raise money for wine. to buy wine. How about
that? Sounds like a plan to me.
Wine for poets.
This is Through the Smoke Hole for Donald Allen. There is another world above this one, or outside of this one. The way to it is through the smoke of this one, and the hole that smoke goes through. The ladder is the way through the smoke hole. The ladder holds up, some say, the world above. It might have been a tree or pole. I think it is merely a way. Fire is at the foot of the ladder. The fire is in the center. The walls are round. There is also another world below or inside this one. The way there is down through smoke. It is not necessary to think of a series. Raven and magpie do not need the ladder. They fly through the smoke holes, shrieking and stealing. Coyote falls through. We recognize him only as a clumsy relative, a father in old clothes we don't wish to see with our friends. It is possible to cultivate the fields of our own world without much thought for the others. When men emerge from below, we see them as the masked dancers of our magic dreams. When men disappear down, we see them as plain men going somewhere else. When men disappear up, we see them as great heroes shining through the smoke. When men come back from above, they fall through and tumble. We don't really know them. Coyote, as mentioned above. Out of the kiva come masked dancers or plain men. Plain men go into the ground. Out there, outside, all the chores, wood and water, dirt, wind, the view across the flat. Here, in the round, no corners, head is full of magic figures. Woman, your secrets aren't my secrets. What I can't say, I won't walk around. Put my hand flat down, you in the round two. Gourd vine blossom, walls and houses drawn up from the same soft soil. 30 million years gone, drifting sand. Cool rooms, pink stone, worn down fort floor, slat siding, heat shine on Jumna River. Dry wash, truck tracks in the riverbed. Coiled sand, pinion. Sea bottom, riverbank, sand dunes, the floor of a sea once again. Human fertilizer, underground water tunnels, skinny dirt gods, grandmother berries out through the smoke hole. For childhood and youth are vanity, a Permian reef of algae. Out through the smoke hole, swallowed sand, salt mud, swam bodies flapped to the limestone blanket. Lizard tongue, lizard tongue. Wah, 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 flying in and out through the smoke hole. Plain men come out of the ground. That's through the smoke hole. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And Gary Snyder is one from that period of Beats who is still, who just evolved and evolved and evolved, right, and is still
doing interesting work.
Still doing very interesting work.
Indeed. Beautiful. Indeed. That is going to be Wordplay for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and I've had the great pleasure of having in the studio today Kathy Smith-Bowers. Thanks, Kathy.
Jefferson, thank you. Thank the North Carolina Arts Council for making this possible. Ione O'Hara, we'll see you at another time. And Bill Van Every, take
well.
Care of yourself and get well. Show you.